or hit the ball first time, and there it was in the back of the net.
Motivation, yes. Motivation, motivation, the 3 M's.
That's perverse. In a football field, with kids watching.
Ladies and gentlemen, England will be playing 4-4-2.
And that, boys, is how to take a penalty.
8-1.
8-1.
Just saying to your colleague, referee's got me the sack. Thank you ever so much for that, won't you?
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Touchline, Episode 2, the football podcast that's not actually about football. Joining me on my... I should introduce myself, David Hartrick. You may know me from such websites as In Bed with Maradona and various others. But joining me on my virtual left is Seb Patrick of Cinematic Universe, Mifflinfinity, When Saturday Comes, Empire... and various, Seb. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yes, I'm glad you introduced yourself this time, because I listened back and realised that you didn't last time.
Yeah, it's a really bad habit. I'm always doing that. Joining me on my virtual right, Dennis Hurley of the Museum of Jerseys blog, Squad Numbers blog, and without revealing sort of how much of the sausage is made, happy Solly March Day, Dennis.
Many happy returns, David. It's a special day.
It is.
You know, and I hope everyone has enjoyed it.
I don't think David Martin has.
No. I hope Solly March climbed down the chimney and gave you everything you asked for. Subject tonight is it's a big subject. We've got a lot of ground to cover, but it's one that is incredibly dear to our hearts. We're talking about Goal TV, and we will go into it in a little bit, but it was a theme night on BBC Two that holds a very cherished place in all of our hearts. But because we're a podcast and because we're three men sat in a room talking to each other, we have to ask an opening question. It's the law. And the opening question this week is quite simple, really. It's BBC Two are commissioning Goal TV for 2019. They're going to turn over an hour of television to you. You can do whatever you want with it. How are you going to fill it? Simple as that. Dennis, we'll start with you.
I have two ideas, and I probably should have come up with more, because on rewatching it, I had kind of forgotten that it's like so many of the inserts were only around the 15-minute mark. But basically, I have two half-hour ideas, and they're both related to hypotheses. The first one is basically just have six people, you know, it could be players, journalists, managers, whatever, but six people... six football people with brains, basically, who are able to think for themselves, and you ask them to change one moment in football history. Which one would it be, and what would have been the chain reaction as a result of that? So you'd have the six of those, 5 minutes each. So that's 1 half hour, and then the other half hour would be filled with, I can't think of a snappy title for it, but basically, to find the best all-round footballer. And that doesn't mean, like, you know, not necessarily the best player, but basically that if you had a load of teams made up of 11 clones or one original and 10 clones, as the case may be, you know, and who would win? So, you'd have 11 Johan Cruyffs, 11 Pelés, 11 Maradonas, and who would actually...
11 Bobby Zamora.
Exactly, yeah. So you could just run that as... it'd probably be easier to just do it with modern-day players and set up a big, massive game of FIFA and have boffins, as they say, at the University of Loughborough or wherever to simulate all the games.
Top men.
But you'd intersperse it with, again, erudite football people giving their opinions on who might come out on top. And we'd see who'd win.
That's a decent standard to start. Seb, you've got an hour.
I've also got two programmes, but one of them would be 20 minutes and one of them would be 40 minutes. For the 20 minutes, I'd like to do what is essentially an updated version of the, one of the segments that we'll talk about later, The Crying Game, which was a segment that talked about people's experiences of watching England versus West Germany in the 1990 semi-final. I would like to do that, but for the 1996 European Championship semi-final, which Dave and I have already just discussed at length on a podcast, but I'd like to see a programme about people's experiences of that night, because that night was my 1990 semi-final. Just so you really can tell what era of the past I'm living in, the other 40 minutes would be given over to a special one-off revived episode of Fantasy Football League.
Well, do you know, the only thing you've got that's counting against you there, Seb, is they have tried to revive the corpse of Fantasy Football League a couple of times, and I must admit, for me, it's not gone particularly well. So I'm not sure. I think Dennis might just be in the lead. My hour is quite simple, really. As anybody who knows me will tell you, I think I enjoy football montages more than actual football. So I would basically have two half-an-hour programmes, montage heaven. First, international. So every closing montage from every World Cup and European Championship, one after the other. The second half, domestic montage heaven. I would raid the archives for montages they've used before and after FA Cup finals, semi-finals, when they used to have the rights to the league ending montage from Match of the Day. I would speak nicely to Sky and see if you could borrow one or two of theirs, like the Flowers of Manchester one they did, which was absolutely excellent. Just have an hour.
Can we ask Sky for the In My Life one from Istanbul?
Oh, the Sean Connery.
Yeah,
Sean Connery one. Yeah, that's a superb montage. So yeah, an hour montage heaven. And to me, like I say, I don't need actual football, just as long as you can feed me montages as long as possible. Last week I said we had to have a winner, and I think I declared a draw in the first pod, didn't I? I don't think I could split them.
You did, yeah.
This one, it would be terribly rude to go with myself, but I am tempted, but I'm actually going to go with Dennis. It's the Fantasy Football League one that's counted against you, Seb.
Do you know, I was choosing between a revival of Fantasy Football League and a revival of Quiz Ball, and I should have gone for Quiz Ball.
Yeah, or a Joshie's Giants revival, as somebody suggested to me recently.
Where are Joshie's Giants now? Where are the Renford Rejects now? That's going to be a future episode.
There's actually a very good website article on that, Seb. I'm not sure if you've read it.
There is, yes. Someone did, yeah.
So, Dennis, you have an hour on BBC Two. Enjoy yourself. Go mad. Don't let us down, son.
Thanks, Dave. But I'm just concerned that when you're adjudicating and a competitor, that you'll always be reluctant to declare yourself the winner.
Trust me, my ego is such that if I think I've won, you will know about it.
That's all right. Thanks.
I'm just worried now about Dennis having an hour on BBC Two, and if that means we're going to get Come Out Your Black and Tans on the BBC again.
Yeah. How does Partridge get away with it? So, on to the main subject tonight, and Goal TV.
Here on BBC Two now, the bank holiday evening continues with a footballing extravaganza. Goal TV.
Visitors and feel sure that we shall be seeing some fine football.
Football, football, send them up the pole. You'll hear their gentle voices calling, fast, shoot, goal!
Oh, yes!
The evening's lineup begins with a tribute to the best loved international side of all time, Brazil, and their 19.
The first thing I want to say to both of you, I would have sworn, I've had a bit of a Mandela effect, I would have sworn blind this was the Sunday night, and it wasn't at all. It was actually the Monday night, wasn't it?
Bank holiday Monday. Yeah.
Bank holiday Monday night. I was positive it was the Sunday night, but I was completely wrong. 30th of May 1994, Leicester have just got promoted to the Premier League via the playoff final.
That USA actually gets referenced in the continuity that night.
Yes, it does. Because don't they pick out a Leicester fan who's been a talking head in one of the programmes? Yeah. Two and a half weeks away from an England-free World Cup, which, to sort of put it in context, 1978 was the last one we'd missed. 1984 was the last Euros we'd missed. So it was a little bit of a strange summer for the English part of this podcast. The Irish part of this podcast, very different feeling going into it, really. But yeah, BBC Two used to do theme nights regularly, and it's at this point, as I sit here remembering Radio Night, TV Hell, Radio One Night, and various others, I'm going to turn it over to Seb to just explain a little bit more.
Yeah, it was this kind of phenomenon that it could only really have come at a certain point in TV history. It doesn't work now in the multi-channel age because you've got so many channels and you've got channels that are dedicated to particular subject matter. So, you know, there's no point doing an evening of football-related programming when that's what Sky Sports exists for. But in this period, kind of... and I mean, the first what you would term theme nights actually kind of started to pop up in the kind of early mid 80s. There was a Rock Around the Clock, a rock and roll night in the early 80s that I think was kind of the first proper example. But the point about it was is that they come from this period where all of a sudden you've got people, TV has been around for long enough that you've got people working in TV who are interested enough in the history of TV to start picking it apart and analysing it and digging up old programming and also, you know, making new programmes about subjects. So there were various of these that happened through the kind of the 80s and 90s. You name-checked it already, but the archetypal example is TV Hell, an absolutely fantastic night of television from 1992. I think it was the August bank holiday, 92, with Angus Dayton and Paul Merton as the linking characters that just basically dredged up bad old TV. That basically a lot of the bad TV that you recognise people talking about now, people know of it because of TV Hell, things like Mini Pops. And if you've ever seen, which I'm sure everybody has, the Attitudes Night sketch on the Day to Day, it's generally a gag about theme nights, but really it's very specifically, it just is TV Hell, basically. Almost everything they reference in that is a reference to TV Hell. So in 94, you get Gold TV. And the beauty of this as well is that it came at the peak of the genre, because if you look a few years later, they're still happening, but they start to tail off. They get a bit shorter. The channels don't really commit as much. There was a fantastic Red Dwarf night in 1998, which, as you can imagine, you know, I know that kind of back to front and back. That had special continuity. That had special programmes made for it. You know, that one was a big deal. There was a fairly decent Doctor Who one with Tom Baker doing links as well. But after that, they started to become, in the kind of late 90s and then into the 2000s, they became, let's put a few programmes on for maybe 3-4 hours and call it a theme night. This Gold TV, it starts at, what is it, it's half seven,
yeah,
and it runs all the way through to whatever time it is in the morning that Goal finishes. 12:45, yeah, is the final whistle. So, you know, it's a full night of programs, and it's a mixture of new documentaries that they've created for the night, a few old programs that they've dug up and kind of dusted off, and kind of old match footage as well, just all flung together for, you know, a kind of a feast of football. And you've got that context as well of, you know, as you said about it being in the build-up to World Cup 94, but it's also, you know, it's 2 years after Sky, it's 4 years after Italia 90. Football is feeling its way still into kind of mainstream consciousness and into becoming the mainstream national pastime. And it's what I find really interesting, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more as we go on. It's not quite there yet in 94. It's getting there, but it's still tentative at this point. Yeah, and that's one of the things I find really, you know, if you did Gold TV now, ignoring the multi-channel age, it would be a very different prospect in terms of how people see football and how people interact with football than it was in 94.
Yeah, this is the thing. A lot of football on TV, and your experience of football on TV up until Gold TV was match highlights. That was football on TV. So the idea of having programmes built around football itself and the game itself was it genuinely felt quite different. Bit of context. Dennis, did you watch this at the time? Did you record it and then dust off a VHS to watch it this time? What was your personal experience?
It was the latter. I didn't get to watch it live at the time because it was a school night for me, because we only have the snooker bank holiday in May. We don't have the last Monday at all. We have the first Monday in May and the first Monday in June. So my father recorded for me the most of it was on one 3-hour tape, and then Goal, the 1966 film, was on the other one. And I ended up watching the one with more on it more often. I think I only had watched Goal probably once before I rewatched it for this. But I did certainly watch the rest of it front to back, and it was eerie watching it again and just kind of knowing what was going to be said, even having not seen it with maybe 20 years, I suppose.
If this isn't a stupid question, what was your access to it? Because obviously it's a BBC Two thing. Do you have it like kind of over satellite, or what's the? How did you get BBC Two?
Not satellite, but. Like in the 80s, people in Ireland were able to get BBC and ITV. Like there was a company basically completely illegally selling it. Right. They were able to access it and then kind of feed it down to people's homes. I think BBC would have probably been available in Dublin since the 70s. I suppose just proximity to the UK, but by the 80s it had a wider reach. We did have those three channels growing up, and then got Sky later. But it would have been, not everyone would have had it, but it would have been close to ubiquitous.
Yeah, my experience, I'm guessing, it is sort of similar to yours, Seb, in that I'm guessing you probably watched a chunk of it live and recorded it all, and then watched the tapes to death as I did.
I don't actually recall if I'm not sure if I saw any of it on the night or if it was just all recorded and I watched it after that.
I remember watching a chunk, but I didn't watch it all. But like Dennis said, it was slightly eerie watching it all again from start to finish, and realising somewhere deep in the recesses of my mind that I knew exactly what somebody was going to say next.
Yeah.
Some weird member of the public plucked as a talking head that have never been on anything before or since. And I knew exactly what they were going to say, particularly, we'll come to it, but particularly when we go to the crying game. There was a lot of sort of individual lines I remember from there.
There are observations in, again, yeah, we will come to them, but observations in that and in the Ball Is Round documentary, which there are phrases and observations that I've parroted sort of as a, this is a really good point that somebody's made, and, you know, this has informed, the way I look at or think about football. I had a sort of, the other thing with me in this, in terms of my relationship with this, is we had the tapes and we had it for years and years and years. And then at some point, probably kind of around the early 2000s, the tape got lost. And, you know, and so I always remembered having this and I remembered watching it. But for many years, it was only something that I remembered and wasn't able to find. And I remember having like discussions with people on the When Saturday Comes forum, among other things, to try and find a copy of this somewhere. And eventually I went into a situation where a guy had it on, across two tapes, and he'd split it in the middle. So he taped it in really high quality. But it meant that, you know, it took up two whole tapes, but he even done a really good break point in the middle of it. So you don't really lose anything. I think he'd done it during an advert. And he had no way of playing the tapes anymore. He didn't have a video player. I had a VHS to DVD converter. So the deal we struck was he would send me the tapes. I could keep the tapes so long as I sent him a DVD of it back, which I duly did. And then I also ripped that DVD onto my computer, stuck chunks of it on YouTube to write an article about it, where they rest still. None of them have been taken down, which is good. Touch wood. When I got those tapes and was able to sit there and go through it again, which was probably in about 2011, 2012, I think, it was just, as you say, I instantly remembered so much of it. I almost didn't need to watch it over again because I was able to recite so much of it.
We'll start going into the specifics, and we're literally going to run through this program by program. It starts with a little 5-minute intro that I want to just say a couple of things about, really. The first is there is nothing... I don't think there's any single ident that makes me feel more nostalgic than the BBC Sport ident from the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that those opening notes immediately just take me back to a time and a place. But then we sort of, the camera pans in on a car in a driveway outside a little terrace house. The registration plate of the car is 1-0. It pans up to a bedroom window, which is immediately sort of engulfed in floodlight. We go through the window into an absolutely magnificent bit of set dressing. Absolutely superb. I don't know about you two, but I wanted that bedroom when I was a kid. I mean, it's just brilliant, isn't it? Because obviously they have to... The whole point of the night is that it's across the length and breadth of TV. But if you actually look and pause, you can pick out somebody, whoever's done that set, is one of us. Is a proper proper football fan. There is all sorts from little bits of merchandise across the ages, football stickers, literal pages from football magazines. It's just wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, the note I've done is just that it's so lovingly put together. Like, there's a lot of thought going into it.
It's got one of my favourite Liverpool shirts in it.
Oh, yeah. Like, you see on, like, a soap opera or whatever, you know, they'll have to do something football related and it'll just be so fucking lazy and cliched. But this is the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, so the ident itself is obviously in the middle of the carpet. It's a green carpet. It's basically like a piece of AstroTurf. And it's just the production value. I think, again, to sort of go back to something we've already said already, this is a product of, way before the multi-channel age. Because now they just wouldn't do this. They'd put something together either on a computer or something, let's be honest, a hell of a lot cheaper to produce and in terms of time. So it's absolutely brilliant. And it uses, for the intro, that I don't actually know what version it is, but it's that jingly-jangly version of the Match of the Day theme.
Hmm.
That I've never been able to actually track down. Do either of you two know what version that is?
No.
It's a piece of music which is called Le Match du Jour, and I can't remember the name of the group that did it.
I might have to set at Football and Music on that, one of my favourite Twitter accounts, to see if he can dig up a decent version.
Yeah, because that and a good few other little pieces from it, They featured on a cassette that I got with Total Football the following year. I think it was around the autumn of 95, and it was called The Best of Bendit, and it was a lot of stuff from the 70s like that, and that was one of the pieces on it. So I just can't remember the name of the group who did it.
It's a superb little version.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really good. But then, so... Obviously, we run through the running order, and rather than run you through it at this point, we are literally going to go through it programme by programme. Some we're going to skip past, some we're going to go a little bit more in detail. And it opens with the sexiest kickoff, Brazil 1970.
So then, kicking the evening off, a musical tribute to Brazil 1970. Pelé, Jairzinho, Tostão, Rivelino and Gerson thrilled us all on the way to winning the World Cup in Mexico.
Which is a complete travesty from the off, because everybody knows 1982 was the sexier team. So it's onto a hiding for nothing from the off. It's basically a 10-minute montage of Brazil at the 1970 World Cup doing great things, interspersed with a bit of contextual, cliched Brazilian stock footage. And there are bits of it I quite like. As somebody, you know, who have already established loves a montage. But the one thing I would say is there is a wonderful little section set to Primal Scream's High. I think it's Higher Than the Sun. And that really does work. But a lot of it is very on the nose, to say the very least. And it's not something I'd imagine that anybody's going to be wanting to revisit particularly quickly. That moves us on to something that people will want to revisit, I think, and that, Seb, is Dear Football.
Nothing tests my emotions like football. Each week I confront my outrage in the form of an imagined letter to the manager, to the team, to the local paper. To George Best, even to God. In fact, I'll write to anyone who's learnt to read, in the hope that they'll calm my troubled mind.
So, Dear Football, I was going to say the first original bit of programming, but no, obviously Brazil 1970 is newly produced for this, not least because you could tell because it got Primal Scream on it. But the first kind of original documentary of the night, and it's a Scottish journalist called Stuart Cosgrove links it together. And the premise is that it's about football fans writing imaginary letters to people or objects or other miscellaneous things within football, usually venting their frustrations. What I find interesting about this one is that it gets made to feel unnecessary because of a later documentary that I think is essentially about the same thing, which is fandom. And really, actually, I think the night as a whole is as much about being a fan of football as it is about football itself, really. That's kind of what the evening is trying to get to the nub of. But there's something that comes along later in the evening that does it in a lot more detail. And Dear Football is a succession of like little gags, some of which land, some of which really, really don't.
I think it's rubbish. I'm happy to say that from the off. There's Stuart Cosgrove, I mean, obviously got quite a storied career in TV, because he went on to be head of content for Channel 4, didn't he?
Not long after this, actually.
The only point of sort of personal interest to me is living in Huddersfield, and the opening vignette where he's walking round a very ramshackle cow shed down at Leeds Road, which is, despite being a Brighton fan, you know, when I was a Brighton fan, when I was 13 years old, funnily enough, I couldn't travel to away games. So I ended up going to see a lot of Huddersfield Town games at Leeds Road. And the crane shot of him walking up the back terrace and then looking out over the new stadium is great. But then you've got other stuff like that Dear Banana. I just don't think it lands.
And the Cantona bit is cringy.
I think the problem is as well, it's just such a dated concept. Because I mean, if you did it now, you'd have to call it dearfootball@gmail.com for a start. So the idea of these sort of romanticising these letters is quite an odd one.
Mm.
But I just don't think it works. There's such a massive variance in quality. It doesn't. When you say some of them land and some of them don't, I mean, when they don't, they are. You just. I was sat there rewatching it. I remember watching this at the time and not really sort of understanding it, thinking, well, it's gone a bit over my head. Can we just have Brazil 1970 again, please? But watching it again now through grown up eyes, I just don't think it's very good. Dennis, can you make any sort of case for this? Am I being too harsh?
The sole extent of my notes for this is that the best thing about that little clip that Seb put together was the BBC World Cup promo was the best part of that.
Yeah,
that pops up a couple of times through the night. Yeah. And is one of my favourite things about the entire night.
Yeah, it's brilliant, but the thing itself is eminently forgettable.
I would like to pick up two things that I like from it. Although one of the things that I like from it still hasn't dated very well, because it's indicative of what I think is the biggest problem with it, which isn't just that a lot of the jokes don't land or that it's randomly got footage of somebody's wedding speech where the father of the bride decides to play the match.
God, that was terrible.
Who even is that?
But it was so bad, like the way he was waiting for a reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, everyone's realised what it is from the first 5 seconds. You don't need to get them to
know. Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, I don't even know why that's in there because I don't know who it is or what the relevance is. But no, I think the problem throughout the whole thing is that it's very, very rooted in old attitudes and in particular Stuart Cosgrove's old attitudes. And pretty much the entire theme of the piece, and that's why I think it's quite interesting that this comes along in 94 when football is reinventing itself, is that the entire theme of this piece is... modern football is rubbish and everything that they're changing is bad and it was better when I was younger. But one of the things that I actually like from it is indicative of that, which is Ray Davies, for some reason, singing a rewritten version of Autumn Almanac, which is one of the best Kinks songs anyway, but which has the line in it, I like my football on a Saturday. And he's taken that line and spun it into a new song about how there aren't terraces anymore.
I still like my football on a Saturday, I go through the turnstiles with all the other fans. Even though they're building all-seater stadiums, it's ironic that they still say they're sitting in the stands. 'Cause the terraces are gone. The
terraces are gone.
The terraces are gone.
The terraces are gone.
Everybody's sitting in the
stands. The other thing that I like, and it's only a really throwaway one, but it's, and I think it's partly because my dad's a West Brom fan, so I empathise with this, but I like the West Brom fan and his line about when he's saying to Neil Young that Neil Young is wrong when he says that only love can break your heart.
Listen, I am being a bit harsh on it. There's one or two, there's a great line where he's talking about the transition to the new stadium, and he says something like it's gonna house the fantasies of goals to come, and I just think that's a great line. But yeah, I've rewatched it for this, and I will probably rewatch it again when I do the whole of Goal TV in one night. But yeah, it's not a great start. We move on to the first of our 5 minute highlight packages, which was the Puskás and De Stefano Cup final from 1960, Real Madrid v Eintracht Frankfurt. It's a great little 5 minutes of a team who were just absolutely exceptional. And then we move into an hour of programming that BBC Two were sort of dredging the archive for. The first of which, one of the things you two don't know about me at this point is I'm a bit of a George Best obsessive. The World of Georgie Best by the one of the greatest to have ever done the job, Hugh McElveny, is just a wonderful 25 minutes to me.
Today there is no footballer with whom the anonymous mass would rather identify than a slim, black-haired Ulsterman named George Best. At 23, Best is accepted by worshipping fans and professional experts alike as the most lavishly gifted player in Europe, if not in the world. So identifying with him requires rather a lot of imagination. His game is an amalgam of superb, almost unnatural balance, unbreakable spirit, a delicacy of touch that stays true no matter how fast he moves, limitless ingenuity and ambition, and force out of all proportion to his physique. He carries onto the field a constant threat of the incredible.
It's the definitive documentary in terms of it's the documentary that every other documentary uses footage from. Mm-hmm. And you've got that McElveny's narration where it's really, really straight. It's slightly jarring to hear it now and to hear him talk of association football. I think it's wonderful. It's a real slice of time. Dennis, am I wrong in thinking it is pretty definitive?
I think for the time, obviously, it is absolutely. It's very enjoyable, and like you say, McElveny gives it a gravitas that, you know, he's close enough to Best to kind of be able to say these things, but he doesn't kind of pull any punches either. It's kind of a bit sad, and the ending is a bit melancholy, and Matt Busby saying that, you know, he hasn't been changed by the developments in his life, and you know that you're kind of headed for a bit of a sad ending there. I also found it quirky that McIlvenny just refers to the national team that Best played for as Ireland, which is just obviously indicative of the time. Again, no one would dream of just calling him Ireland nowadays.
No. It's from the minute Don Farden track Belfast Boys starts up, and that early footage of Best, and he just, you know, apologies Seb the Liverpool fan, but he just looks so good in that Man United kit. You realise that we watching that in 2019, it can only really end in a pretty melancholic way, however they chose to end the documentary, really. Seb, as a Liverpool fan, but somebody who must be able to appreciate Best, I personally think it's just a wonderful 25 minutes, but that's because I have quite a heavy personal investment in it. Talk me through where you are with it.
Well, I will just say at this point, though, that even though I am a Liverpool fan, I suspect I'm the only one of us here who's seen George Best play.
I never saw him play. I met the man, but I never saw him play.
In 1990, probably two, I went to Bruce Grobbelaar's testimonial, and at half time there was a like six-a-side game with old players and celebrities, and George Best was one of them. So I have watched George Best play football at Anfield. But even as a Liverpool fan, even with my strong hatred of Man United, I think there are two Man United players in history that I genuinely liked and admired. One of them is Peter Schmeichel, and the other one is George Best. You can't not enjoy, you know, and whatever you think about George Best and his life afterwards and anything like that, you can't not enjoy George Best, watching George Best play football. If you don't enjoy watching George Best play football, you don't enjoy football.
Yeah.
And this documentary I found really interesting going back to it, because I definitely remember at the time, you know, the original times when I would have been watching this video, I probably skipped past this one a fair bit because I probably thought, oh, it's a bit old, I'm not that interested, it's about a Man United, I know who George Best is, but it's about a Man United player, it's from the 60s, it's a bit slow and dull. But yeah, going back to it now, it's a fantastic piece of television. I find interesting the stuff that it glosses over, because it does talk about his kind of celebrity lifestyle, and you've got that footage in the nightclub. That for me is the most enjoyable bit of the whole thing. That is fascinating, that glimpse.
Is that the champagne fountain and everything?
Well, there's the champagne fountain stuff, but actually, no, not so much that, because I think that's when he's launching a boutique. No, there's just footage of him just going out to a local nightclub. The nightclub is run by the horse racing mogul.
Yeah.
And just that footage, particularly as someone who me and my wife are quite interested in the 60s and 60s culture and style and look and everything and decor, so that was a fascinating watch. What I find interesting though is that it touches on that side of his lifestyle, but at the same time it kind of shows him kind of at home with, you know, with him still living with his landlady at this point, and it doesn't go anywhere near is where he might have been spending his nights, you know, when he goes home from the nightclub. It gives you the impression that he's, you know, this kind of nice, quiet guy who likes to go out and kind of enjoy, you know, kind of people's company and that kind of thing, but who then goes home in a quite virtuous way to his lodgings. And as we know, you know, at this point, that couldn't really be further from the truth. So I think it's interesting that it doesn't kind of delve into that, because it's not looking to be sensationalist, and that's not what it's looking to do. And as you say, what it does that is really, and I think quite bold for something of its time, is that it allows itself to have that melancholy of, you know, obviously now we know what went on in George Best's life afterwards, but this looks at the uncertainty. It goes, look, you know, he is an amazing player now, he's on top of the world now, but we don't know how long this is going to last. He doesn't know how long this is going to last. He doesn't know what he's going to do next. And that final shot of him standing on the bricks, you know, it's really, really well put together piece of TV. And yeah, you can't not enjoy Hugh McIlvenny's narration. It just lulls you and just draws you along. It's so compelling, you know.
Then we have, well, an absolute stone-cold classic 30 minutes of television, don't we? We are, of course, talking about No Hiding Place, which is, I mean, it's no exaggeration to say it is the episode of Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads that everybody remembers.
Who do you think will win the match, then?
I'm you.
Heard what? With the news from Bulgaria.
Don't tell us!
We want to watch you on the box tonight.
You'll never last out till tonight. Let me put you out here.
Don't tell us!
2-0!
Can I be controversial here? Right. For starters, I love this, and we'll go into more of that more in a minute. And again, you know, I know of this, and I know of the like of whatever happened to the Likely Lads, and I like whatever happened to the Likely Lads because of this theme night. And I've seen this episode more times than I would care to count. I don't think it should be in here because it's not really about football.
No.
It's like the episode itself isn't even really about football. It's the one where they try to avoid the result of the football match. But if you actually watch the episode, so little of it is actually about that. It's taking up 30 minutes of a night of special programming about football. And I am glad it's here. I really am. I adore this. It's probably my favourite thing that's in the whole night. But I also don't think it should be
there. Shouldn't this podcast be in favour of something that's not actually about football?
Touché. It's the best episode of one of the best ever British sitcoms. The thing about Whatever Happens to the Likely Lads is it's not just that it has no hiding place and then a load of mediocre episodes. There are other episodes of the show that are almost as good as this, but there are none that are as good as this.
No, and it's been... The proof of the pudding is in the fact that it's been, you know, parodied and referenced and still
remade.
Is to this,
remade, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, to this very day, you know. I sit here as well, I'll go into the Ant and Dec version from 2002 in a minute, because I'm guessing you two might not have seen that.
I saw it at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. But Dennis, do you think it stands up?
Obviously, there are a lot of parts of it that would not get past the editing process nowadays, in the same way that episodes of Fawlty Towers wouldn't. But as a farce and an episode of comedy, it's outstanding. It's even, like Seb says, having seen it so many times, you still laugh and, you know, you still enjoy it because it's just... So well crafted and so well integrated. It's it really is a classic, and you know you would question its validity in there, but you know it's still a nice inclusion.
Yeah, the last 2 minutes are, I think, among the best 2 minutes in British sitcom history.
Yeah,
I really do.
Like the way that they've earlier voiced their dislike for figure skating, and that just seemed like a throwaway line at the time, and then they're just watching the TV,
Japan,
and you just see them kind of leaning forward bit by bit as they realise what's happened, and then as they realise what the headline that England effed on the evening newspaper.
I come from exactly the same place as you do, Dennis, in that I think it's a wonderful little time capsule that there's a lot wouldn't get, you just couldn't do it now. But it led me down a rabbit hole because I went on YouTube and I did watch the Ant and Dec version again. I remember watching the Ant and Dec version in 2002 and being of a less discerning palate at the time, thinking it was all right. It's surprisingly fateful, but God, yeah, it's like you realise the things that are missing are the chemistry and the timing and, you know, like even John Thompson, who I'm a massive fan of, even John Thompson can't save it. You know, he plays the Brian Glover part, but I'm with you, Seb, actually, and I've actually got on my notes that should it be here? And I am a bit with you that particularly in the half eight slot, you know, like in sort of the prime hour, really.
I feel like it's been put there kind of for two reasons. One, just as an excuse to dig up and put on an episode of something that they liked and wanted to put on. But I think it's kind of there for comfort as well, because it's recognisable. It is a famous, you know, before this it was a famous episode. It was the episode of the Likely Lads even before this. And actually, seeing as I've just said it, can I just do my little quibble on this as well, which is in the continuity and throughout they refer to it as the Likely Lads. It's not the Likely Lads. It's whatever happened to the Likely Lads. They are two different shows. They feature the same characters, but they are different shows from different decades. Whatever happens to the Likely Lads is not another series of the Likely Lads. It's a show in its own right. It's also a much better show. The original Likely Lads isn't very good. Whatever happened to the Likely Lads is odd episode aside, is largely brilliant. It's got one of the greatest, just to go off on a tangent, one of the greatest first episodes of any sitcom ever. The opening episode that sets up the premise. We talk about like the construction and the farce in this one. The first episode is almost as good. The situation that it contrives to put the two of them in, the situation that it does, it's an immense piece of TV. But anyway, yeah, so I think the point is that this was recognisable to people. A lot of people watching the night will already have seen it, and I think will have tuned in for that specifically. I think it's there as a way to draw people in, is why I think it's there.
I have a feeling, and this may be me ascribing memories to the night that weren't necessarily there, but I'm almost certain that was the one part of the night my mum and dad actually sat and watched with me. So yeah, that probably proves it right. We then go into another 5-minute highlight section, the most stupid, appalling, disgusting, disgraceful exhibition of football possibly in the history of the game, according to David Coleman.
Chile in other Italy words, one of the best.
Yes, yeah. Chile from Italy, 1962. But I was, you know, look, this, it's quite an odd game to put in as a 5-minute section, because it was a hell of a long time ago by the time, you know, Gold TV is on. It's what, 32 years ago? And it's not, you know, it wasn't a great game. It was just a game where people kicked lumps out of each other. So you sort of think they had the whole breadth of football up until that point to choose from. And I think they really dropped the ball. I think it was, I don't know why this is here, other than to hear David Coleman say it's the most stupid, appalling, disgusting,
well, that's
disgraceful
why, isn't it? They've put it in as the opposite of the beautiful game, haven't they? And yeah. I find it incredibly enjoyable to watch. It's not one of the greatest games ever. I think the others, I mean, I don't think the Real Madrid Eintracht Frankfurt is one of the greatest games ever either. I think it's just there to show it, you know, because they're kind of going, almost going through the decades, and it kind of shows a team at the height of their powers. I think, as we'll come to them, the other two games they pick absolutely are two of the greatest games ever. But yeah, I don't think this is there to be that. I think it's there to be, but then I wonder, actually, if you look at some of the segments we've got, and like the football hell one coming up, I think, should you not have just taken David Coleman's bit and just put that in another segment so that we could see it there?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I have thoughts and feelings about football hell. We'll get to it. so that closes out with the little comedy short from Tony Hancock with Sid James, and then we go into Nick Hornby's The Ball Is Round.
It must have been a form of entertainment once upon a time, I guess. A ball, a few mates, and it's time for your tea before you know it. But then something happened somewhere along the line, and all this sex and misery and fear and euphoria and mania crept in. For most of us, the importance of the game is that it's the one constant, the thing that ties adulthood to childhood. We're all the same age on planet football, and we'll never, ever grow old.
Seb, just explain a little bit about it. It's one of the longest, well, it is the longest original section on the night, isn't it? And it's quite a fascinating thing. I wouldn't say it's brilliant, but it is definitely fascinating.
It's definitely this and one other segment to come later on are the bits, moments of which have lingered with me the most, and that I've remembered. When I used to talk to people about this thing called Gold TV that I used to have on video and didn't have anymore, this was the thing I would refer to the most. I mean, what it really is, in a way, is it's Nick Hornby doing a sequel to Fever Pitch, because it's pretty much about the same thing that Fever Pitch is. It is about the psychology of football fandom. It's about what football means to the people involved in it, the people who watch it, why people are football fans, what we get out of it, how we experience it. It is narrated by Nick Hornby, and I presume he wrote the linking material that he narrates as well. I don't know how involved he is in the putting together of the whole thing, although we were talking off mic before about how the fact that one of the contributors is a mate of his called Neil Cass, who is name checked quite a lot in Fever Pitch, so I suspect he was quite heavily involved in putting it together. And then you've got an assortment of contributors, and Dave, I don't know if you kind of want to run through some of them or...
Well, to be honest with you, I got lost watching it. let me explain a bit. I don't know if you two have ever read The Soccer Tribe by Desmond Morris, which is one of the sort of key texts of football when you talk about in terms of fandom and what it means to people, etc. And when I was watching The Ball Is Round, it felt like they were cribbing whole sections from the book. And I sort of got... It's quite a fascinating thing because Nick Hornby is obviously a fabulous writer. He's had a massive success, real breakout success with Fever Pitch. But this does... I don't know. It's hard to describe because if you don't know the book, you may not necessarily know what I mean. But even structurally, it feels like it's cribbing really heavily from the book. So it's quite... I found it quite an odd watch. I don't know. I find it a bit strange. But yeah, Dennis, what's your experience of it?
Well, I have to admit, I haven't read The Soccer Tribe, but I'll have to try and dig it out now if what you're saying is that it's so...
It's a brilliant read, yeah. And it's... I think it was first released in the 70s, and it's still in print now. The last version, I think, has got a foreword from Jose Mourinho and came out a couple of years ago. But it is a sort of definitive text.
Yeah.
And I think if you go and read it now, you'll actually get quite a similar experience. So where Nick Hornby is sort of having you believe that he's sort of uncovering the layers, you know, he's peeling back the onion and he's finding all these different angles, I was sort of sitting there thinking, well, yeah, because this is all from The Soccer Tribe.
Yeah. What I would have said about it was that it's a very kind of When Saturday Comes kind of a piece, you know, they're real fans, you know, they're not kind of, they're substance rather than style, basically. I would question the way at the start that he refers to Pele as our leader unquestioningly. I think Pele's kind of reputation in the quarter century since has kind of suffered a bit just from being everywhere and selling whatever he can.
Erection pills. You may as well just say it.
Exactly, yeah. I think at the time he was just held in high regard because he was a great player, and FIFA were and are and always will be seen as bumbling fools, and he was seen as an antidote to that. There were some interesting contributions. At the time, I didn't know who Mark E. Smith was, and I'd forgotten in the interim that it was him, so that was a kind of a jolt to be reminded of that. And then I enjoyed Billy Whitelaw talking about her husband, who kind of, you know, he'd treat himself to go and see a first 11 of a non-league team, like, you know, he'd be going to second 11 reserves of places near him. Like, it's...
I think they're the sort of golden moments in it. I think where it doesn't work is like where they're talking about, you know, is football art, and they go into a little bit into the argument and what have you, and then that's for me where it doesn't quite work. But what you've picked out, Dennis, like seeing Marquis Smith at any point is a joy, but seeing him pop up and here is great, and some of those little stories, they're brilliant. It's when I don't know, it's when it sort of seeks to answer a bigger question that isn't necessarily being asked.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
I get what you mean.
It's also, though, those are points where, and to kind of touch on something we talked about before, when it's making itself kind of, when it's trying to be about football, it's not as interesting as when it's being about football fandom. You know, I think where it's interesting is raising that question of, well, why do we care about this so much? What does it do to us? What is it that means that we all turn into these weird people of being football fans? And there are moments that I really like. There are, as I kind of said before, you know, there are little observations that I've kind of taken away from it that I think are really nice lines. Our fellow When Saturday Comes contributor, Harry Pearson, has a couple of good bits in it. A very, very young Harry Pearson. And there's a point where he talks about how when you're a kid, you play at things, you play at being a grown-up. You know, you pretend to be a policeman or a fireman or a soldier or whatever. But when you play football, you are playing football. You might be pretending to be a famous footballer, but you do actually play football. And he's like, he said he thinks it's maybe the first and possibly the only grown-up thing for some people that you ever actually do. And I've always liked that one. And there's Susanna Frankel, who has actually these days, I looked her up and she's a fashion journalist. And she made what is my favourite observation in the whole thing, which is when she says, the difference between football and other sports and in terms of how we relate to it. And it's, you watch, say, tennis, and most sports are about getting things right most of the time and being perfect, and they hinge on making a mistake. And football, you know, when you go and sit down to watch a football match, that 99% of the time they're going to be lousy, and what you're waiting for is that one moment where they do something absolutely brilliant, and that's what makes it worthwhile. And I've always, that has always kind of stuck with me, that line, and I've used that line so often to describe to people the difference between football and other sports.
The other thing I think is weird on it is I think the editing is weird, because like when they're talking about football as art, like in that section, just randomly it cuts to a completely routine Graham Stewart goal for Everton where he just side foots the ball in. I think it possibly even takes a deflection in sort of a nothing game against, I think it's Charlton. And it's like, I don't know, it just... I feel like I'd love to get all the footage from this programme from when they made it now, and I reckon you could recut it now and have something really brilliant still.
I mean, you could make it about 50% better by just cutting out the woman with the Chris Waddle poem.
Yes, yeah. I don't know, it doesn't quite land for me. As I said, it's that thing of asking questions that I don't think it always answers. But it is interesting. It is a fascinating 40 minutes, isn't it? It's one of the things that going back to this that I was really looking forward to watching. And even though I have issues with it, I still thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, I don't know about you two revisiting it, but I still thought it was thoroughly enjoyable despite my hang-ups with it.
Absolutely, yeah, it was. And I remember at the time, originally, that and The Beautiful Frame were probably the ones I enjoyed most. So I was definitely looking forward to seeing it again. And I think Marky Smith just probably summed it up best at the end, where he lamented that it had become too trendy, and you can multiply that 10 or 20 fold from that time until now.
Yeah, it would be interesting to do a follow-up, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It really would. We then move into 10 minutes of what is titled Football Hell.
Ronnie indeed was a side intellectually out-argued by a Darrow team thrusting and bursting with aggressive Kantian positivism. And outstanding in this fine Darrow team was my man of the match, the arch-thinker, free-scheming, scarcely ever to be curbed, midfield cognoscento, Jimmy Buzzard.
You've got to really just take each game as it comes. I know everybody says that.
And we'll just take each game as it comes.
Take each game as it comes.
Take each game as it comes.
Brian, what's your reaction?
Well, I'm over the moon, really.
I'm over the moon, I tell you.
Over the moon, I'm delighted.
I hit the ball first time, and there it was in the back of the net.
Do you think Jarrow will adopt a more defensive posture for the first leg of the next tie in Turkey?
I hit the ball first time, and there it was in the back of the net.
It's just weird. And half of what they're pointing to in this sort of what Football Hell is it's basically a 10-minute flash cut stroke montage of various mentions of football, football songs. There's a couple of sort of comedy sketches which are bits are ripped from. So there's like a bit of Mary Whitehouse Experience pops up with the football chant inventor. But half of what they're here bracketing under football hell is actually really good, isn't it?
Well, that's,
or is that just me?
Because as you say, it's a mixture of... There's a little bit in the middle of just showing some quite funny own goals, and there's a little montage of football cliches being said by people. There's a young Harry Redknapp at one point in the bit where it's lots of people saying over the moon and at the end of the day and all that kind of thing. What's weird is the rest of it is largely good comedy sketches about football. And what I also find weird is, this is like with Dear Football, this is something that is kind of made to feel a bit pointless by the fact that later on you've got a programme. Now, that programme is not without its own flaws that we'll get to, but there is a programme that is all about football on TV and on film and has lots of clips from programmes. But then this has also got clips from comedy programmes taking on football. So it's weird. There's various Monty Python bits, or you know, kind of other stuff with the Python team, and all of those bits, and the Mr. Chumley Warner bit, which they show the introductory bit from the Mr. Chumley Warner football sketch, and then they don't show any of the Liverpool Arsenal bit, which is the whole joke of the sketch, which is bizarre to me. But you know, those bits could be in The Beautiful Frame, which comes later on. I like little bits like the bit of quiz ball. And stuff like that, and a little bit about the commentator competition, but they're so short and they're not explored that they're just kind of pointless. I also would like to know, and don't know, what both the first and almost last bits are from. So I think we could talk about the first bit in a minute, but there is a sketch towards the end, and it really bugs me that I don't know where it's from, which is it's somebody's dubbed over the Liverpool players being introduced to a dignitary at a match, and he's asking them all Trivial Pursuit questions, and it's quite amusing. And I've always there's the last line about Rushy doesn't know, that I've always found quite funny.
The longest river in Peru,
it's like a footballing version of Animal Magic, Morris.
So if anyone knows, tell me what that's from. But also, it starts with, well, I mean, again, does anyone else want to describe how it starts? Because I don't know how to describe it.
It's like a series. Well, I mean, am I wrong, Dennis, if I just say it's basically like a bunch of weird puppets?
Yeah, like my notes basically say what the fuck, because I'd almost forgotten that bit. It's like it's like the opening of a 60s show, and then it's interspersed with a phone call from these evil puppets, and you don't even know fully what they're saying at the start, except Victory for England.
Mm. No.
And then it cuts back to the 60s.
And I can't tell if they're from the same thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering as well. And then it just goes to the England Euro 88 squad performing their song on Wogan.
Which is brilliant, and I won't have anybody say that is bad. It's one of my... I mean, don't get me wrong, it's brilliant for slightly cringy reasons because of the way they're dancing around, but it's a great bit of footage. But they're literally at one point, to sort of explain how it cuts, these weird puppets, which at one point there's like a fire in the background that's never explored or explained, by the way, are like watching this on a TV. It's just weird, and I don't think I will ever watch it again. I'll be honest with you. I don't think I'll ever watch it again.
I like the fact that it featured the... Sports Night theme tune, which was another classic.
But football hell can be consigned to hell for me. I don't think it works at all.
I do like it introducing me to there's a Python sketch that I hadn't seen before this, which is the World Forum one.
Yeah.
Where he's asking the communists the quiz questions. That is, what I partly like about it is that the question that is no
true,
which is the trick question about Coventry City having never won the FA Cup.
Absolutely.
So after the sort of 40 minutes and quite sort of hefty discussion from the ball is round, we have 10 minutes of just weirdness from football hell. Then we have Italy versus Brazil from 1982, the Rossi game, 3-2. Absolutely categorically one of the top 10 football matches of all time. And I can completely understand its inclusion here.
Of all of the old match stuff included here, I enjoy this one the most aesthetically. Because even though like 1982 isn't my era, you know, I was born in 82, so you know, my era of football is 1990 onwards. There is just something about the combination of everything in this, from the kits, which are perfect, the brightness of the day that it takes place on, the colour of the pitch, the ball being the Adidas Tango ball, the look of the goal nets, Dino Zoff in his grey kit, and John Motson's commentary sounding like it's coming from, because it's Spain, isn't it? But it sounds like he's coming from some far flung south down the phone jungle, line. Down a phone line. Yeah. Every aspect of it is just aesthetically perfect. I mean, it's not perfect, it's flawed, that's the whole point. But it feels to me so viscerally what a World Cup should look and feel like.
That's exactly what my notes were for that as well. It's just, I had written down what football should look like.
yeah, it is. Then we're halfway through, so we have a little 5-minute montage of basically standard images of halftime, people having bovril, halftime draw, people stood around having their, you know, having a cup of coffee and what have you, in and amongst a sort of series of footballers in adverts, many of them that you will have seen, you know, Pat Jennings jumping around as an oil filter, etc. The outlier, the one that I don't think I've seen anywhere else, is Kenny Dalglish being dubbed into Chinese. That is quite a that's quite a strange experience.
It's one of those where I'm like, does the footage exist of what he's actually saying before he's dubbed there, or is the advert only ever shot for Japan?
But then we have a little curious 10 minutes that we've already had a couple of discussions about off air, and it was a chance on the night to vote for the greatest goal in history, called, imaginatively enough, the greatest goal. It should have been called the greatest goal that we have the rights for, but that's another story.
Taking part in the greatest goal couldn't be easier. To register your vote, simply call 0891 7474, followed by the number of the goal you choose. For example, if you want to vote for the first goal scored by Carlos Alberto, then telephone 0891 747401. But don't call just yet. First, sit back and watch the 20 greatest goals of all time.
There's a theme to a lot of the goals, isn't there? Which is, if you've stomped one in from 30 yards.
It's
a and there's one or two that feel like real outliers. Like, you've got the Peter Beardsley goal against Brighton, which it feels weird in and amongst this sort of company, really. And it's quite... I mean, if you... The thing I thought is, one of my favourite videos on YouTube, one of the videos that I come back to all the time, is the BBC, before the 1986 World Cup final, Mexico, they did a best goals of the competition, you know, a similar thing, vote for your favourite goal. And the quality of Mexico 86 was so good that I think there's 20 goals there as well. And it's absolutely stonking. There is every type of goal in there, from, you know, Maradona's run to volleys to team goals. That 20 goals from that tournament, I would argue, is better than the 20 they've got here for the greatest goal, really.
I mean, I think, with a few exceptions, and there are exceptions, I think most goal of the season competitions have a better lineup than... I think the issue that you've got is, as you say, it's partly to do with goals that they actually have, A, the rights, and B, footage of. And obviously, you know, this is from 1994, and they're trying to kind of do a spread across eras. Like, even then, I think there's only one goal from the 90s, which is Gascoigne's...
the free kick against Arsenal,
Which, to be honest, is a fantastic free kick, but also the only reason I would have it there in a list is for Barry Davis's commentary, because it's my favourite ever piece of commentary. Mm. I'm not sure, you know, I still think there are better long-range free kicks. I think, you know, but from this point onwards, pretty much, from 94 onwards, I think you've got a combination of, you've got so many more goals being visible to people because there's so much more televised football. But also, I mean, I do genuinely think that we are at a point where, you know, the level overall of technical skill across the breadth of the game of football, not just at the top level, is higher than it was in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. So you could put together a list of 20 goals scored in the last maybe 5 years, most of which are better than most of the goals scored here. Not all of them. I think there's Van Basten, there's that Nelinho. I've still never seen another curler like that Nelinho one. And there are a couple of others, you know, which are undisputed classics. But I think we're at a point where too many great goals like that are scored now.
Here's a question for you then, Dennis. Who would you have voted for as the greatest goal?
I think you would still have to give it to Maradona. What they've done with the 20 goals, they just said who the scorer is. They haven't said who they're playing for, who they're playing against. There's no context applied. You know, a goal in an ordinary league game is never going to win one of these.
And like
you both have said, the spread of quality across the 20 is quite broad. I suppose at the time, you didn't have the access to older footage that we do nowadays, where you can look up every televised goal ever. It was pretty rare to see the goals. And like Seb says, you wouldn't have seen as many good goals. So probably in 1994, it didn't seem as pronounced, you know, how mediocre some of them were. But, you know, there definitely could have been a bit more quality control. Like the two George Best entries are very ordinary by his standards.
Yeah. It feels like it was put together by two blokes, one of whom was obsessed with 101 great goals. Because, you know, you've got, there's the Liam Brady goal and both the Best goals and a few other, you know, the Hoddle chip against Watford that are, you know, real like 101 great goal classics, basically. So, yeah, it's an odd collection. It's an odd collection. I think now, I've often had this discussion on another podcast. I think the things we gravitate towards now, like you say, are the things that we haven't seen again. So like Nelinho's curler, Van Basten's volley, you know, in a major final like that, I don't think has been bettered.
That's why I think, I mean, for me, I think it is Van Basten. Because I just think, yeah, you don't see another goal. But I think it's hard to almost objectively argue against the Maradona goal, because there are sometimes other goals where players will dribble the length of the field and run through a team. I remember a great George Weah one. But the Maradona one is still the best example of anyone doing that. And that still happens much more rarely than someone crashing in a 35-yarder. And the context of the game in which it was in, And everything that surrounds it. I think that is the nobody will score a goal quite like that ever again.
It's like Dennis said, they offer these goals up, they don't give you any context, and context is incredibly important. I'm sorry to mention this, Seb, but Ronaldo's overhead kick against Juventus last season was great, but Bale's was much better because it's in the final. You know, it's the context is everything. To pull that off in the final with billions of people watching is just incredible. So again, it's a bit of a time capsule, isn't it? It's a list of the time. But as I said, they could have just gone back to 1986 and it would have been absolutely fine. Saying that, in my hour of Goal TV, if you remember that, that top 20 would definitely be part of Montage Heaven, so it's covered anyway, not an issue. So after that collection, we go on to 15 minutes I fundamentally disagree with, as somebody who has been, I'm now nearing my 40th birthday, and I've been a striker since I was 7 years old. As far as I'm concerned...
I was going to ask about this perspective.
As far as I'm concerned, goalkeepers are scum and they're there to be punished. So to devote 15 minutes to them is just appalling. But Lertranger, I think that's how you pronounce it.
The last defender, Vladimir Nabokov. Of the games I played at Cambridge, soccer has remained a windswept clearing in the middle of a rather muddled period. I was crazy about goalkeeping. In Russia and the Latin countries, that gallant art had always been surrounded with a halo of singular glamour. Aloof, solitary, impassive, the crack goalie is followed in the streets by entranced small boys. He vies with the matador and the flying ace as an object of thrilled adulation. He is the lone eagle, the man of mystery, the last defender.
...15 minutes looking into the world of the goalkeeper. I find it quite an odd 15 minutes watching it back. Do you think that's fair comment, Seb?
I fundamentally disagree with you from a complete point of philosophical difference, because I'm a goalkeeper. So, for starters, I hate you as much as you hate me. But also, I think the interesting thing about strikers and goalkeepers is all goalkeepers also secretly want to be strikers, but I don't think any strikers ever want to be goalkeepers.
No. Scum.
Yeah, so I am a goalkeeper who, when I play outfield, the only place I will play is up front, because I will want to punish an opposing goalkeeper. I really like this. I actually think of the original documentaries done for it, it's one of the more successful. I think it does what it's doing far more successfully than Dear Football does. I think it's got some little bits that maybe don't necessarily need to be in there, but I think it's nicely put together. I think it's got a nice hook to it, which is essentially goalkeepers are different. Goalkeepers are a bit weird. I like the interviews that are in there. I think all of the goalkeepers that they talk to come across well. I don't know why there's a random guy from Cambridge University in there, but you know, you've got Jim Leighton, you've got a long-haired Casey Keller, you've got
Budgie,
we've got Budgie, of course. You've got Erik Thorstvedt, who, for some reason, and I don't know why, is one of the earliest goalkeepers that I remember being aware of.
I'll tell you exactly why, Seb. Because
I know why.
I've had this discussion before. It's because of that first televised
Premier League game
where he dropped in. Yeah. I think it was Teddy Sheringham's shot that he put his hands up and spilled and it went in. That's why everybody remembers Erik Thorstvedt.
And also he would have been their keeper in the 91 Cup final, which was the first Cup final that I watched live on TV. It's quite slight. I like Dave Besant in it as well, even though he's talking about the Wimbledon penalty save. But I like the fact that it contrasts, you know, him having that heroic moment with him talking about his time at Chelsea. And you get a similar thing with Jim Leighton talking about, you know, when goalkeepers get in these situations where you're at a club and everything's going wrong and there's more scrutiny on you than anywhere else on the pitch. And sometimes for a goalkeeper, you're just in a situation where that situation is broken and you need to go somewhere else. Mm. So all of that, yeah, I mean, you know, it is a slight little 15-minute thing, but... I enjoy, as a goalkeeper, I enjoy it. I don't know where Dennis plays, so I don't know where he falls.
Oh, I was a right back, except for two seasons where a clueless manager put me left back and I kept having to come back in on my right foot, but that's beside the point. While I was watching it, I had kind of forgotten some of the content and I was like, did I not cover the negative side of it? And I was thinking it's a bit unbalanced otherwise, but they did, of course. It's funny that Casey Keller features and he's also the subject of the little photo essay in the new edition of When Saturday Comes, which is a nice parallel, and there's another one later.
And I thought
it was odd that John Burridge said that the guy said to him, to be a goalkeeper you have to be crackers and daft, which I thought would be the same thing anyway.
But it is
good. I think it could have benefited maybe from longer than it got, you know, and you could kind of delve a bit more into the positive and the negative sides of it. But you know,
there's definitely a half an hour program, isn't there?
Yeah,
rather than 15 at 15 minutes, you really are sort of wiping over the surface of quite a lot of it, aren't you?
Yeah, because it's the one position that kind of is held for more scrutiny, so it could have been examined a bit more.
Then we've got the France v Portugal from 1994, which I'm really glad is in there. It was a great game, but I have a little personal thing that French team from 1984 is like... it's one of the great forgotten teams, really, of history. Nobody really talks about them when they're talking about the great teams. And they were absolutely sensational, and Platini was just brilliant. But I am nothing if not a camera angle nerd. And I maintain that the camera angle for the free kick, the first goal, where it's behind the goal looking down, is just superb. I just think it's great. And I wish we still had that camera angle in the game, because that is live footage. So they're not behind the free kick taker or from the angle. They're literally behind the goal as he's taking it in real time. And I am all for that, chaps. I'm all for that.
I'll tell you who / what else is absolutely fantastic in that. Is Bento, the Portuguese goalkeeper. Sorry to go on about goalkeepers again. But basically the reason why that match is such a good match is because of how well he plays.
Yeah, because it was all one-way traffic before the Portugal equaliser.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's also... It's one of the... it's one of the sort of the high-profile games for late drama as well, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Then we go into the crying game, which was a bit painful for me and Seb, but utterly joyous for you, Dennis, I would imagine.
I wasn't that bothered, really, you know. I'm in the school of thought, oh, well, that's it, that's the end of the game. Be another one in 4 years. Sadly, that was not to be.
We were at York doing bounces with John Godwin and the Truck Theatre Company. So the amazing thing that night was the fact that there was anybody in the theatre at all.
You see, what you've got to bear in mind, it was a golden period in world history. It was before Iraq invaded Kuwait and after the Berlin Wall came down. All the teams who were supposed to be in the World Cup were there. No one had boycotted it, so it was a wonderful sort of window of peacefulness. It was the end of history.
Oh, certainly, we'd have had the evening off, yeah. So we'd have paid them to go home. Go around if there was been a handful of them, it's been known, to go and give the audience some money back from the actors. They go home, I'll pay for your ticket. Because there's a rather important football match.
I wouldn't say that. I don't even remember that game. Like, I remember a lot about the World Cup from an Ireland point of view. I don't remember the semi-final, but I do remember the final. But maybe just because of the detachment, the contributions aren't as memorable for me. I do like Des Lynam's intro where he says half the country will be watching it.
Yeah.
What the other half are doing will leave up to them. Some of the anecdotes are mildly interesting. Some are very boring.
One of the anecdotes. Well, there's a couple of the anecdotes that are basically. One was, yeah, I watched it on holiday, and one was, yeah, I watched it at work, and that's basically the whole cut and thrust of the of the anecdote.
Yeah.
It's great that it opens with the opening from Des, and some of the talking heads. Oh, great. Martin Griffiths, I wanted that. I've wanted that Soccer is Life T-shirt all my life. It's just a superb T-shirt. Kevin Allen's bit is a bit interesting. And I always think Kevin Allen is quite underrated.
Yeah, it's like when he pops up in a comic strip presents, usually one where Keith Allen has already been very loud and obnoxious, and then Kevin Allen turns up and you're like, oh yeah, he exists as well.
Yeah, you know, he did a lot for stuff like Standing Room Only and what have you. Mm. You know, there's that great bit that it may be on YouTube, it may not, I don't know, but it's Kevin Allen who goes over to meet Wayne Lineker as he's opened the first Lineker's bar. But you're exactly right, Dennis. Some of the anecdotes are just. I mean, it could be the three of us sitting here, couldn't it? Just saying what happened.
Yeah. Oh, I robbed the telly. The guy caught me, and he said, "Oh, it's fine." And I was clutching my World Cup bottle of wine.
And yeah, we were on a campsite, and we went to watch it on French TV.
Yeah, and penalty is la penalty.
I think the sort of notable part of it for me is the ending. With REM, Everybody Hurts, and footage of Sir Bob and then Gazza crying.
I like all of the... I think where it works the best is in telling the story of the game And in using music choices to reflect the emotions at each various point.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
You know, the way it uses Stop Your Sobbing for the Lineker equaliser is great. And yeah, you know, that, just that, that swinging mood of the game. And this is the thing, I think, this is where I feel it's... I mean, I do enjoy it as a piece, and it is one of the pieces that I remember well from this. But I think what this has the opportunity to do, because what it's about is these were our experiences of... watching this pivotal match as it went on. And I think it spends too much time with people talking about the circumstances of where and how they watched it.
Yeah.
And not, then this happened and this made us feel like this. Because when it does have people talking about that, and I think the people who you've heard of, your Kevin Allen and your Arthur Smith, actually talk about that stuff more. They don't so much talk about, you know, oh, I happen to be here. And that's the stuff that I think really works, and that the whole thing should really be, well, this is what we were feeling when this happened, and then this happened, and this is what it meant to the nation, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a funny little 15 minutes, you know.
It probably suffers a bit from being just 4 years after the fact.
Yeah.
You know, that'd be like something on about 2015, and like 2015 was yesterday, like...
Yeah. That is weird. It's presented, and I think probably partly because I would have remembered watching it over and over again many years after 1990. It feels like they're talking about something from, you know, 10, 15 years ago as they're talking. And it's like, well, they're not. It's less than 4 years ago. They haven't even got to the next World Cup yet.
Yeah.
And they're talking about it. But that's why, well, you know, on my pitch from earlier, talking about 96 now would be interesting because that's 23 years ago, not 3 years ago.
You lost, Seb. Yeah. You got get over it. You lost. it's a funny little 15 minutes, you know, and I still can't excuse somebody thinking that, oh yeah, here's a bloke. He ended up, you never believe it. He ended up watching it in a factory. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, fair enough. But then we get the result of the greatest goal, which was Maradona's from 1986, I think quite rightly.
Spiders.
You know, my personal preference is for Van Basten, but, you know, public vote, fine. We then get another play of what was basically three quarters of the opening of the BBC credits for USA 94, except it didn't have the like fade effect, and obviously the opening credits when they came around didn't have Des Lynam and Jimmy Hill popping up in cowboy outfits.
I love that.
So we've had a it's an odd little 15 minutes, the crying game. Seb, set up the next 15 minutes, and it's 15 minutes that I think we've all got quite a lot to say about.
From the days of silent movies to up-to-date TV drama, that's the sort of thing directors think they can get away with when they ask actors to play football. And who am I to disagree?
The Beautiful Frame, which is kind of this podcast, but hosted by Claire Grogan. So it is Claire Grogan, obviously famous to most people as either from Gregory's Girl, hence why she's doing this, or as the lead singer of Altered Images, but probably better known to me as the original Kachansky from Red Dwarf.
And also an episode of Father Ted, where she plays...
And an episode of Father Ted.
Sinead O'Connor, yes. Basically.
The only episode of Father Ted that's not quite as good as all the other episodes of Father Ted. But yeah, so it is basically a compilation of clips of TV shows and films about football. And this is where, you know, I think a lot of my knowledge of and interest in football fiction probably does come from. And it you know, because there is a mixture of, there is a segment where you've got footballers or football related people appearing in things that aren't necessarily about football. But largely it's, here is the treatment of football in fiction, at least up until 1994. And there are lots of things in this that I think you would have heard of outside of it, and there are a lot of things in this that I would not know the existence of if it wasn't for this.
Dennis, there are bits in this 15 minutes that I've never seen anywhere else. So, for example, some of the opening footage, the Harry the Footballer from 1911, the lucky number, the card... I've never seen those bits of footage anywhere other than here.
Yeah, and I'm the same. And like, it really is an impressive trod of the archives, again, when you consider the lack of, you know, the lack of access, you know, electronically compared to nowadays. And I'm the same, like, I've never seen or heard anything of Bourne kicking outside of this. The same with the manageress.
Bourne kicking and the manageress are two where I really want to dig those up and watch the whole
thing. Yeah.
Bourne kicking is the one I remember. Obviously, I remember the manageress. I watched the manageress.
And that's also featured in the current edition of When Saturday Comes.
It is, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Bourne kicking is the...
Screen one.
Yeah, it was
it?
A screen one. It was a 1 hour show, and it would have infuriated you two, as it infuriates me to this day, because it was about QPR and they took the trouble to use Loftus Road and the relevant kits, but the match action was A, it was absolutely dreadful, and B, you could see repeatedly that there was nobody in the ground at all. Oh, there was no crowd whatsoever. So my abiding memory is all your action shots in it are shot from really weird angles, you know, so you can't see.
Yeah.
Well, there is the clip you get in this of the her penalty. Scoring the penalty.
Yeah.
And the angle of the ball going into the net and the movement of the keeper is just so bizarre. It just doesn't, like, I mean, we are gonna, on this podcast, over the course of however long we do this podcast for, we are gonna talk about screen match action quite a lot, because like 95% of the time it's terrible, and I can only think of a few instances where I think it's been done really well. And one thing I will say, again, just to bring us back onto the topic, is the thing that gets done wrong more than almost anything else is goalkeepers, because, and I understand why, which is that it's really hard to act almost but not saving a shot. Do you know what I mean? It's hard to let a shot past you and not look like you've let it past you deliberately. And that's why most of the time, if you see a football match in a film or on the TV, it looks like the goalkeeper has moved out of the way and let it in deliberately, because that's the only way to act it. And that the example you get here in Bourne kicking is a really bad example of it, but there's some as well in, like, I mean, I think you can forgive it in Jossie's Giants, because like it's meant to be crap. The thing I won't forgive with Jossie's Giants is they use a lot of clips of Jossie's Giants in this, which is fine, but they get the name of the show wrong on the captions. They put an extra E in the name Jossie every time they caption it, and I think they use Jossie's Giants about 3 or 4 times.
Well, they use it early on. Rubbish, that's what we are, rubbish. Yeah. And they use it in the footballers section.
They use it for Brian Robson.
Yeah.
Hiya, Jossie. Heard you were coming today. Good to see you, kidda. How's the horses treating you?
Oh, I'm a reform man. Football's taken up all my time. How's things at Old Trafford?
Hard work, same as ever. Just like this programme.
Well, we'll be rooting for you, Brian, won't we, lads?
Yeah.
Nice to see you, lads.
Right, good luck, Brian.
See ya.
But it's... The first thing is, like... I mean, I was a teenager when I watched this, and I definitely didn't objectify Claire Grogan at that stage in my life, honest boss. but she's a great little presenter. You've got that weird cameo from Glenn Hoddle just popping
for
up.
No reason.
Yeah, out of the blue. And like Dennis said, it really is quite an impressive trawl, because, you know, like digging up that bit of Coronation Street with Hilda Ogden in her...
In a
football kit, and you know, there's obvious bits like the Arsenal Stadium mystery that are, you know, relevant touch points in football and film.
Yeah,
I think it's unfair that they use in the, so they have the section about, you know, like footballers can't act when they've got real life footballers thing. I think it's unfair that they lump in Graham Souness in that, because that scene in Boys from the Black Stuff is, A, it's brilliant, because it's Boys from the Black Stuff, and B, Graham Souness is really good in that bit.
You're Graham Souness, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're famous.
Well,
I'm Yossie Hughes.
Pleased to meet you.
You would look like me.
Oh, aye.
Magnum as well.
Pardon?
Magnum, a detective. He used to be on the television. An American.
Oh, aye.
Yeah, but I would also say that Tommy Doherty is really good. Yeah. When he's doing that bit in Loving It, I think he's... something that's sort of quite close to me and Dennis's hearts is All in the Game, and Lineker's acting in that, Dennis, is it's extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah. Don't forget rule number
like
three,
the whole thing of that.
Score some goals, you dope.
But like, how do people get that wrong when they're playing themselves?
Sashimi futatsu to sake onegai shimasu.
Arigato gozaimasu.
Thank you very much. Bloody hell, you've cracked that too, have you?
Well, let's wait and see what she brings. She'll probably bring 2 tons of cuttlefish or something.
Look, I really want to make this work, you know, Gary.
Well, don't forget golden rule number three, then.
What's that?
Score some goals, you dope.
Like, it shouldn't have to be such an ordeal.
There are definitely a lot of things in this, and I think that is one of them where... All I know of them are the bits I've seen from this, but it's made me want to try and see more of them. I think a really good example of that as well is those Glory Glory Days, which from all of the bits of it that you see in this, looks great. I'd really like to actually watch that in full. I've never seen it.
It is actually enjoyable. I saw that about 21 years ago, I think. And the guy playing Danny Blanchflower is actually... John Salthouse, who was Frank Patcham, the youth team manager in Dream Team.
Oh, right.
Excellent knowledge. Yeah. Excellent knowledge, Dennis.
And there's a little clip from The Lovers, which is great. That's a oft-forgotten 70s sitcom that holds up quite well.
Yeah, there's a wonderful bit from Alf Ederson Pat as well. Superb. It's just... And it completely holds up. Like... I would quite happily watch A Beautiful Frame over half an hour, updated, with a bit of Renford Rejects and everything else.
Mike Bassett.
Yeah, and everything else. I'd be more than happy to watch that, particularly if it was presented by Claire Grogan again.
She earned her money, to be fair, because like there's a load of different locations for probably very short little inserts between each section.
It's nicely put together. I think it's one of the bits... I mean, obviously, in order to do all of the archive digging, and there has been good archive digging, I think it is the segment that feels like it's almost had the most... Maybe with the possible exception of Ball Is Round, that's had the most work put into it. The fact that it's structured, it's got... I mean, it's cheesy, but it's got that section-by-section thing, which means, the clips do flow into each other because they're all roughly on similar topics. It does do that thing of digging up kind of interesting things you might want to see, things you might not have heard of. The one I find weird that it digs up, when I looked up what it was actually about, is the Harry H. Corbett clip. Which is from a film called, and I've forgotten the title, so I'm just giving Rattle of a Simple Man. And that is about an excessively mothered man who goes on a coach trip to the football with his friends and who sleeps with a prostitute while he's away. So it's kind of like that clip kind of works in the context, but it's like if you actually know what the rest of it is. And also his mum is Thora Hird. It's Harry H. Corbett and Thora Hird. So there's lots of like those little kind of sort of discoveries there throughout it. Obviously, also as well towards the very end, we haven't even mentioned it or touched on it, is the fact that you've got Ripping Yarns in there.
Eight bloody one. Yeah.
Which is just superb.
Yeah.
It's just brilliant, isn't it? And it, like I say, it just completely stands up,
I think I could possibly do, I think the penalty bit in the middle where they wheel out Brian Glover and a cardboard cutout of Sylvester Stallone.
And that, boys, is how to take a penalty.
Look one way, kick the other. Sylvester never saw it.
Which is funny in itself because they obviously haven't been able to afford the rights to actually use any of Escape to Victory. Yeah. I think that bit's just a little bit pointless. It's good that they've got the Cares bit in there because you have to have the Cares bit in there.
Well, funnily enough, I saw it on Twitter, was it last week or the week before, completely coincidentally, and someone had just said, this is the Donald Trump presidency in football form.
And that's, that's very true. But I think the last thing to add on The Beautiful Frame is that it's great to see a programme like this on the BBC where they've been allowed to properly trawl the archives, and there's, you know, there's stuff that originally appeared on Channel 4, there's a lot of ITV stuff in there, a lot of stuff from films. It's, yeah, you know, real hats off to the people involved. And yeah, completely stands up. Goal then follows, which is the film of the 1966 World Cup, the official FIFA film. Now, I'm a bit of a mug for an official FIFA film for the World Cup. I think it's a real shame that they're not done anymore. 2010 was the last one that was done, and it was a bit of a token effort. They did one in 2014 and it never saw the light of day, and I believe they just haven't bothered with Russia. But you have to... They've put it on Gold TV because, obviously, it's 1966, it's England winning the World Cup, but I think it's worth just explaining a little bit about the context of Goal and how massive that film was. You know, like, there are better official World Cup films. Hero is much better, but... Like, you got to understand, everybody watched the 1966 World Cup in black and white. So they got the chance to watch Goal. It played in cinemas and they could watch it in colour, which would have been a pretty incredible thing at the time. So it's quite an important one. 1954 was the very first, but it wasn't done to this standard or in this... with this sort of aim. And yeah, I quite like it as a bit of a time capsule. But I am a sucker for such things. Dennis, you said you have notes.
I do have a few. It's like, just given how everything else is relatively brief, it does seem a little bit incongruous that you have an hour and 40 minutes planked on at the end. But there's no continuity announcement afterwards, so I presume that was part of the reason, just to allow her to go home. And I thought it was odd that the opening credits are set to the free kick, Germany's free kick that led to the equaliser. You know, it obviously everyone knows how it ends, but it just seems strange to me that Germany celebrating is the centrepiece of the start of it. Brian Glanville's script is excellent, and what I like about it is that it's quite actually sparing, in that, you know, there's no match commentary and the narration doesn't completely overshadow every game. You know, it's sometimes one little irritant is that it's slightly ahead of what's going to happen. Again, you don't need spoilers, or spoilers don't matter, but there's just no need for it. You know, it says a guy scores, and then it takes a good 3 seconds before the ball actually goes in.
It's like the famous bit that's in World in Motion, the We Want Goals against Mexico. They got one, a beauty scored by Bobby Charlton. So, well, let us see exactly, it before you tell us that it's going to happen.
And I did like how he referred to, I think was it Hungary playing in a novel 1-4-3-2 style, rather than saying a sweeper system. And as well, the chance, the England, when England were playing, the chance in the semi-final, it was, when the whites go marching in, which could be misconstrued, but for the final, to be fair, they changed it to when the reds go marching in. And as well, obviously, the use of the Union Jack rather than the St. George's flag, which I think didn't really become popularly associated with England until 1990, is that right?
I'd agree with that. It's a bit of a time capsule. It's with anything sort of FIFA produced, there's sort of a layer of gloss to it. But I really quite like the sort of the different camera angles that are used, and the different moments, you know, from the final that are caught in Goal that you don't associate it when you, because you don't see them when you watch the match itself. And you're right, it's a whacking great slab at the end of a night that's been broken into little pieces.
Yeah,
so it's almost like they've got to this point and gone, what do we do now? It's either show one of the World Cup films or escape to victory. You know,
and we can't afford escape to victory.
So it's a funny way to end. Then we go to the final whistle. As you said, there's no continuity announcement. It's tragically the last time we see this bit of set dressing in the Idents, which are, I mean, again, I can't tell you how good they were. You could do that for something now and it would still look absolutely brilliant. And over the sort of closing credits, we hear the... Do you realise what that little bit of commentary is about? It's going back to the time where they used to sort of print a square in the newspaper so that when you listen to the commentary on the radio, that's why he's going, he moves into square seven, square six. So you could follow it. So it's one of the sort of very earliest examples of radio commentary. So it's quite a nice way to end. But I think before we move on to the final section, I think revisiting it, I loved it at the time, and I think revisiting it, I think despite having hang-ups with lots of it, I think I love it even more because it feels like something that's just never ever going to be repeated. So it feels like this special little ship in a bottle to me. What are your sort of feelings towards it, Dennis?
Yeah, I agree. In my 13-year-old naivety, I was expecting something similar in the late spring of 1998, and it didn't happen. So that kind of, you know, made me kind of cherish it even more, realizing that it had literally been a one-off. And I'm just so glad that I had it to watch, like so much for 4 or 5 years, and then, like you say, coming back to it after 20 years and still just holding it so dear. And like you say, most of it still holding up, even in the modern climate.
Yeah, there are bits that you could basically, Seb, take this entire format and just do it again today, couldn't you? You could update... All you do is you could update Dear Football to, like I say, dearfootball@gmail.com. The beautiful frame, you just have half an hour and you run it. The ball is round. You're almost coming at it from a different angle at this time. You could still do exactly this, couldn't you?
I mean... I think you could. I'm not sure I totally agree with you. I think you could and you couldn't. I think, I mean... the sections, yes, kind of do substitute nicely, and you can see that, you know. And yeah, I'd love to see, you know, an updated beautiful frame with all those more recent things we've talked about. I just think there's too much football now. I think in 1994 there was exactly the right amount of football and of culture about football that you could do something like this and not feel like you had missed out loads of stuff. Obviously it does miss out lots of stuff, but it doesn't feel as a night like it's only touched on a very tiny corner of where football was at that point. I think in the 25 years, I think the amount of football and football coverage in the 25 years since then is so much greater than in the 25 years before it, that I think it would just be unwieldy now. I would, if I was asked to do a Goal TV in the year 2019, I would be like, well, where the hell do I start? You know,
the beautiful frame.
I think they'd just be okay. I to be honest, do you know what I'd do? I would make the whole night be stuff like that. I wouldn't bother to do documentaries about football. I would do documentaries about things that were, oh wait, that's what we're already doing with our podcast.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's our subject matter? But that's the point. I think you could do a whole evening of The Beautiful Frame and just do a whole evening that was about, here is looking at, you know, and in some cases show a full episode of something, show that Likely Lads episode, show some other half hour things, and also do some compilations that just show you the bits of it that you need to see, and finish it off with a film. And by a film, I mean Mike Bassett, England manager. You know, just, yeah, go get the Billy the Fish cartoon in there as well.
We will come to Mike Bassett, don't worry, we will come to Mike Bassett. So yeah, so that's Goal TV from start to finish, really. A great little piece of football on TV history, really, and something that it would be safe to say, you know, is so far up all three of our streets, it's moved in next door and we're having a barbecue next week. Seb, Somehow I Manage,
yes.
Me and Dennis have no idea how you have been doing with Nottingham Forest. So me and Dennis can just sit back, and this is as much of a mystery to us as it is to you, dear listener.
Yeah, so I've got to figure out how to sort of present this in terms of, do I just go through the whole thing, all of my notes chronologically, or kind of group them by talk about transfers, talk about matches, that kind of thing. What I will say is that where I've maybe not got as far as you might have expected in terms of matches. I actually did all of this in kind of mostly one session over the course of a few days rather than doing it gradually over the month. Where I have got up to is I think we are in mid-September. I've played 8 league matches because I kind of didn't want to go too far, and I thought, because I've spent so much time dealing with transfers and looking at the squad and sorting out the squad, you know, whoever takes over after me probably won't get as much opportunity to do that, so we'll have to play more matches. But mid-September is where we've got up to. So just as a quick reminder for those who don't remember from the first episode, we're managing Nottingham Forest in the 97-98 season. What I identified in the squad that we talked about last time was that I really thought we needed a central midfielder, because I think the options at the start of the season were Jeff Thomas and I can't even remember who else I had played. Jeff Thomas and Scott Gemmell were my two central midfielders, so that really needed bolstering. I also wanted to look for another winger, a striker, a right back, and potentially a centre back as well. So I put in bids for another Champion Man 97-98 player who I'm a fan of, who I've had great success with in the past, Freddie Leon, a Colombian striker. I put in a bid for a Portuguese winger called Luis Miguel Cavaco, Clarence Acuna, a Chilean defender, a Polish centre-back / central midfielder called Darius Adamczyk, and Michael Thomas, who I don't need to introduce to anybody. Elsewhere, while all of this was going on, some big deals started to go through. I thought it'd be interesting to tell you about some of the deals that went through elsewhere in the world that I saw come up as news stories. Kieran Dyer has gone to Spurs for $4 million. Darren Eady has gone to Chelsea for $5.75 million. And Nigel Quazzi has gone to Arsenal for $5 million.
Bloody hell. Well, that's Arsenal getting relegated.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We discussed the possibility of selling Steve Stone if offers came in around the $6 million mark. Based on the fact that I had a few positions that I wanted to strengthen in, Blackburn offered only $5.75 million, but I accepted it and he went. So Steve Stone is at Blackburn and we got nearly $6 million quid to add to the pot. So I think at this point we had a transfer budget of around $12 million in total. Michael Thomas rejected the move, so we didn't get him. And Adamczyk accepted but didn't get the work permit. But we did sign Acuna and Cavaco as the first signing. So we got a decent Chilean right back and a Portuguese winger who looked very exciting. Then Andre Salenzi got injured in training.
That's probably a plus.
Yeah. But even so, it did weaken the options up front. So started to kind of look and think about that. In order to replace Steve Stone, I thought we'd look at another winger. So I looked at a player called Roberto Capellacci and put in a bid for him. Also put in a cheeky offer because I realised that he was in the same division and so might accept a move for George Kincladsey. And amazingly, the bid was accepted by City and he agreed to talk. So that negotiation was going on at the same time as the negotiation to get Freddie Leon to join. Leon wanted 27k a week, which completely blew away the wage structure. I actually offered 32k because Bronby were in for him as well, and he went to Bronby. But we probably couldn't afford to pay him 32k a week, so that's probably for the best. Offered Kincladsey 26k a week, and he still said no, even though it was more than he was asking for. So we didn't get Kincladsey, which I was really disappointed about. So by this point, we hadn't had a big marquee signing. We'd signed kind of a couple of squad players, but the season was starting without me kind of making the big splash to replace Steve Stone that I was hoping for. First game of the season, played a standard 4-4-2 against away at Norwich, with Van Hooijdonk and Steve Guinan up front, Steve Chettle as captain, that midfield that I mentioned of Gemmell and Thomas, and I gave Acuna and Cavaco their debuts. We drew 1-1, away at Norwich. Guinan scored after 53 minutes, but then Norwich equalised. Then we got a few kind of bits of disappointing news. Capellacci chose not to join. That was when we got the Kincladsey rejection. Bobby Gould got sacked by Wales, and Sol Campbell went to Juventus for £8.5 million. Then second game of the season was away at QPR. Same lineup as the first game, lost 2-1, 2-0 down after 77 minutes, and then Pierre Van Hooijdonk scored on 80, but it wasn't enough. So two games down and we had 1 point, and things weren't looking great. Bought a player from Crewe called Steve McCauley, who is he's that odd fish of a centre-back / centre-forward. But he had 20 for tackling and 20 for heading and 19 for set pieces. So he doesn't look great as a striker, but he seemed a decent option at centre-back. So we got him in. Still trying to find a central midfielder, bid for a Chilean player. Third game was away to West Brom, and I decided to mix up the formation. So as we talked about, I'd gone with a kind of traditional 4-4-2, but because of the age of the game, I decided to go with a 4-2-3-1, something a bit more modern. And brought in Chris Bart-Williams for Steve Guinan and gave McCauley his debut. We were 1-0 up. Cavaco scored his first goal for the club after half an hour. Then Chris Bart-Williams had a goal disallowed while we were 1-0 up, and then we lost 2-1.
Nottingham Forest fan TV must be great.
Yeah, so 3 games in and 1 point. So this really was not going very well at all. So I did two things for the next game. The first thing was I abandoned the 4-2-3-1 immediately and went back to 4-4-2, but switched to a passing style. Chris Bart-Williams back in the team on the right wing, Salenzi and Van Hooijdonk up front. And I also switched the fullbacks. So I put back the already existing fullbacks rather than new players that I brought in. We beat Crewe 2-1 at home. Salenzi and Van Hooijdonk with the goals. Van Hooijdonk's was a penalty. So we got our first win on the board. The other thing I did, after failing to spend the Steve Stone money on a midfielder that I wanted and struggling for goals, I put in a £4.8 million bid for Marcus Stewart because he had 6 goals in 5. At this point in the season at Huddersfield he was. So he seemed to be having a good season in the same decision, so I thought let's take a punt and go for him. Game 5 was away at Oxford, same lineup as Crewe. Disappointingly, Cavaco, who'd had a good start to his career with us, got stretchered off after 25 minutes, but we won 4-0 away at Oxford, so up to 7 points after 5 games. Once again, we failed to get a central midfielder that I was going after, a guy called Sierra, who I'd been after for a while, chose to go to Independiente. So then I put in a 100k bid for a Peruvian called Martin Rodriguez. In the meantime, we were at home to Sheffield United, had to bring in Ian Wone on the wing for Cavaco, and we won that one 2-0. So we were up to 7th after 6 games. Game 7 was away to Stockport. And I had to make some changes. Pascolo, the keeper, had to drop out because he was way on international duty for 2 games here. So Mark Crossley had to come in. And despite going behind to Stockport early on, we won that one 2-1. And then immediately after that, Marcus Stewart agreed to join for £4.8 million. So that's our big splash of a signing, is Marcus Stewart. And Rodriguez also came in for 100k, so we finally got that central midfielder. So after all of that, game 8, you can see why after all of this, I only played 8 matches. Home to Port Vale, Rodriguez came straight into the team for Scott Gemmell and Marcus Stewart in for Salenzi. And a goal and an assist for Marcus Stewart on his debut in a 4-0 win at home to Port Vale. So in mid-September, we are 5th in Division 1, 6 points behind the leaders, Middlesbrough.
Good start then, to be fair. Good start.
Well, after the first couple of games, I was thinking, God, am I going to have got sacked before before any of you get to take over? But turned it around with the change in formation. And I think bringing in Marcus Stewart is going to have been a shrewd move. But you've only got one space left in the squad now as well. So if you want to buy anybody else, you're going to have to start selling players.
When you said that you couldn't get Sierra, I thought you might go for Mondeo instead.
Dennis, are you taking the reins next?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that and bring it all tumbling down.
Yeah, why does it feel like the next time I speak to you, we might be managing, I don't know, perhaps Brighton and Hove Albion.
Walking. If, oh, yeah, because Brighton...
If memory serves, I think we were 97th that season. 93rd, sorry.
Yeah,
just
drew with Hereford in the last day of 96-97, wasn't it, to relegate Hereford?
Sorry. It's just all got suddenly a bit painful in here. That was Beyond the Touchline episode 2 on Goal TV. We will have more fun stuff for you next month. We are yet to decide on a topic yet for next month. We have a list to work through. So yeah, we don't know what we're talking about next month, and that's kind of exciting. Brilliant. Thanks a lot for listening for all this time. I hope you enjoyed our look back at Goal TV, which really was a little special bank holiday night, to be fair. So we'll see you all next month. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.